Interview with Rear Admiral A.H.G. Stores, 19 of April, 1997. Admiral Stores, perhaps we could start this afternoon by you giving us a brief rundown of your history and experience with the RCN when you first entered, and move forward until you became CO of Shearwater in 1953.
Very well. I first started off as a reservist in the RCNR in 1940, a lieutenant, and served throughout the war as a RCNR officer, ending up as an acting commander. Then in 1946, I was invited to transfer to the RCN in the rank of a confirmed commander, RCN, which I accepted very happily. My first appointment was at headquarters, and then in 1948 I was given command of the Nuuko, which was one of the original tribal caste destroyers, for a year, and after that I went to the National Defence College as the naval member of the directing staff and a commandant who was the very famous General Guy Simmons. After that I went back to headquarters again until 1953, when I was appointed to Shearwater as the commanding officer, and for a little over a year, nearly 2 years, and then I went to the Magnificent as commanding officer in 1955 and stayed there until August 1956, when I went back to headquarters as acting assistant chief of naval staff warfare for a year, and then I became assistant chief of naval staff air and warfare after the Navy decided not to replace the head of their headquarters air element with a seconded naval officer from the Royal Navy. Then in 1958 I was promoted to Rear Admiral, went to the National Defence College as the Commandant until 1952, when I retired.
When you were appointed Commanding Officer of Shearwater in 1953, what sort of experience had you had prior to that period with naval aviation in the RCN?
I'd had no direct experience, and in fact apart from a personal lifelong interest in aviation and as a private flyer, my first exposure to naval aviation was during the war on the North Atlantic with what was known as a carrier aircraft merchant ship, which carried about two or three swordfishes on a deck on top of a grain ship. And this was so very obviously an essential part of a convoy that it made a tremendous impression on me and intensified my interest in aviation, and particularly in naval aviation. But apart from that, and then as much as exposure I could get to flyers and to naval flying, I had really no direct association with it until I went to Shearwater in 1953.
When you became CO of Shearwater, this would be very early for helicopters in the RCN. I would have been primarily for the Icebreaker and the Bell helicopters for the utility squadron. What were the initial reactions to seeing helicopters just entering service with the RCN?
Well, I don't think I don't recall any very strong impression at all. They were there. They were largely experimental. At that time, they were seen, I think, only as a communications vehicle, and of course the function that they had with the Labrador for ice reconnaissance and again also for communications. But certainly in 1953, I don't recall any thought or discussion at that time of any great extension of their use beyond that kind of thing. Even in 1953, certainly as far as my own experience, and I think experience generally in the RCN, they had not reached a very advanced state of development. Their payload was not great. Now, there may have been developments in the USN and perhaps in Europe that I wasn't aware of. Frankly, I think my own interest was not very great. Having gone to Shearwater, I was far more interested in fixed-wing aircraft and their function, both in the AS and the fighter role and our relationship to the fleet.
Would the S-55 Sikorsky helicopters just have been entering service when you were during your tenure as CO of Shearwater? Or very near the end of your time at Shearwater before you became commanding officer of Magnificent?
As far as I can recall, we still at that time only had the two, the little two-seater, and I forget which that one was. Do you know what
that would have been the Bell 47, I think, yeah. With the bubble canopy?
That's right, and the Sikorsky that we had. The Sikorskys were embarked at that time as and taking over the role of plane guard from the destroyer which had been previously. But I don't recall any other helicopter. May have been there was one attached to the X-10, but I don't remember that.
Right. So when you became CO of Magnificent in 1955, the RCN had just procured these early Sikorsky helicopters. Pilots had been sent down to the USN for training in Pensacola, Florida, to perform plane guard duties and that sort of thing. And then they were embarked aboard the carrier. What was your reaction as CO of the carrier now to have helicopters embarked to perform the plane guard duty, for example?
Of course, it was a great idea. It was far more efficient than the destroyer. And just digress a moment, apropos of this kind of thing, in 1948, when I was in Manuka, there were no helicopters then, and the destroyer was used as a plane guard. And it was a most cumbersome business. For one thing, the tribal-class destroyers were not very nimble ships. They had been designed originally as heavy gunships for battles in the English Channel, using them as anti-submarine vessels wasn't very satisfactory. And certainly, and to start with, there's the absurdity of you had to lower a boat. And in those days, ships, motorboats, weren't very reliable. And you're never quite sure whether the damn thing is going to work anyway. So in the meantime, there was this pilot floundering around, what the hell are those bloody fish heads up to? Why don't they come and fish me up?
Right.
And it was really all very embarrassing and very tiresome. So the arrival of the helicopter was a wonderful thing.
Do you remember, as CEO of Magnificent, any mishaps with the helicopters while they were performing plane guard duties? I know that the early Sikorsky helicopters, like most helicopters, were underpowered. Some considered them unreliable. They didn't have very much endurance. Did you ever lose a helicopter while it was performing?
No, I don't recall ever having a ditching of a helicopter. I was in that, maybe.
Would,
however, just to divert a moment, another thing that was very pleasing about the helicopter, it enabled us to pull off a nice little bit of showmanship. In the UK, a kind of up yours to the Royal Navy, when on our first visit while I was in the ship, I was going to call on the High Commissioner in London So I got our people to get the necessary clearances from the air traffic control people for us to fly up the Thames, land on the south bank, and then I'd be met back. I had to go to the call on the High Commissioner. This, as far as I know, was the first time anyway that a Royal Canadian Navy helicopter had flown up the Thames.
Right.
And this was just delightful. We all loved that.
So you had no qualms about getting aboard these early helicopters?
No. And another occasion, we were in Portsmouth, and an old school friend of mine was the commanding officer in Ganges, which was the Royal Navy Boys Trading Establishment. So he invited me to go for the weekend and inspect divisions. And so I said I would arrive in a helicopter, and he was very upset because the only place to land was on the cricket field. And he was terrified that this Richard machine would spoil their cricket pitch, and he was very concerned about this. We managed to do both, to arrive by helicopter and not spoil his cricket pitch.
That's great. Do you remember what sort of exchange would have had to have taken place if we're now embarking two helicopters aboard Magnificent for plane guard duties? Would that mean that you would have lost a fixed-wing aircraft because it couldn't be accommodated in the hangar?
The accommodation is very tight. They are small carriers. And the amount of number of aircraft you could carry was very, very limited indeed. And you could not have sustained a 24-hour operation at sea in a submarine battle situation with a convoy for any length of time. So the arrival of two helicopters meant certainly that you had to get rid of at least one of the Avengers, but I don't remember the details of how they were packed in.
Would you have also lost one of the fighters as well, or was it just strictly a loss of one ASW fixed-wing aircraft?
I really don't remember. That was a housekeeping thing. Once we had accepted the fact that there had to be an exchange of some kind, I just don't remember the details. I'm sorry, I can't help you with that.
All right. As CO, and you were concerned for all operations, flying operations, and making sure that everything was proceeding smoothly, having helicopters land aboard the carrier presented new and different difficulties, I assume, particularly for the aircraft handlers, securing that aircraft to the deck so that it wasn't moving about. Was that a particularly tense time for aircraft handlers aboard the carrier?
In bad weather, yes. They weren't very good bad weather aircraft. But it was simply a matter of the commander air in consultation with squadron CO deciding at what stage you have to decide no longer operate helicopters. It wasn't a command decision in the sense that in wartime there might be an occasion where the captain, because of his interpretation of operational requirements, should say, well, I know it's dicey, but you have to go on operating. That's a normal wartime situation, of course, with any aircraft. But in the Cold War, although we were, of course, always conscious that we were not very far away from a real war, there wasn't wartime operation imperatives of that kind.
Do you have any recollection of normal flying operations taking part aboard the carrier, but the helicopters, because of wind conditions or sea state or a combination of both, could not perform plane guard duties and the destroyer would have to carry that out?
No. We always had the destroyer there anyway.
Right.
At that time. But I don't remember any particular.
So you...
I think there may have been more likely... Well, I'm guessing. I was going to say more likely situations where the helicopter wasn't operating because of unserviceability and the destroyer plane guard was left to cope. But I just don't remember any occasion when weather was the factor.
So you would say that during your time as CEO of Magnificent, it was having helicopters embark then was overall a good thing?
Oh, heavens, yes. It was an excellent thing. And the helicopter section were very keen. They did their best to go on flying under most difficult circumstances. They're very enthusiastic about the whole thing. And so were the fixed-wing flyers, naturally.
I assume
because they had a much better chance of recovery with a helicopter there than with the plane gun.
With the destroyer.
Yeah.
The operation, I assume, would have been a much quicker operation.
Yes, it could be there in a matter of almost of seconds before the helicopter was over the ditched pilot.
But I assume from the pilot's perspective of flying these early helicopters, they were particularly concerned about their own circumstances as well, given the unreliability of some of these early aircraft.
Well, to a degree, yes, but don't forget that the helicopter pilots were trained, efficient, competent helicopter flyers, very aware of the capabilities of their aircraft and aware of the limits on what they could do with this airplane. I don't think they were that concerned about serviceability, because the maintenance staff were trained and competent and efficient. I don't think it occurred, certainly never occurred to me, that there was any concern about whether the thing wasn't going to work because of lack of effective maintenance or anything like that. And it's not like today with these aircraft now, which are, what one heard, are a pretty risky operation because of their age.
Do you remember during your time in Magnificent having to respond to queries from headquarters about the operation of helicopters and how well they're performing, how you saw them and their role in the RCN?
I don't recall ever having to make a report on the use and employment and operation of helicopters, which was the only kind that have come my way. Any queries about the day-to-day performance and maintenance and technical elements of flying helicopters would not have come through me.
So any information that you could have provided to headquarters would have appeared in things like reports of proceedings?
Yeah.
And they could glean whatever information from that?
Yeah.
All right. So you left as CEO of Magnificent in 1956 to return to headquarters?
Mm-hmm.
And assumed the position of ACNS Warfare?
Yeah.
So in that position, did you have very much to do with naval aviation, either rotary wing or fixed wing?
No, very little.
Very little.
There was one or two naval aviators on the staff of ACNS Warfare in the anti-submarine element. So, as regards weapons, weaponry, and the method of conducting anti-submarine operations, the combat side of it, the development of philosophy and the requirement for weaponry, there was very naturally a great deal of interchange between the ACNS Warfare and ACNSA at that time.
Right. When you returned to headquarters, the Buckingham trials would have been completed in 56, and the Ottawa trials were taking place in 1957. Were you aware, as ACNS Warfare, of the changing or the advances in rotary wing aircraft and the fact that they were becoming more and more important?
Yes, this was a part of operations, and naturally it was of very much interest to ACNS warfare, because this was an extension in the development of anti-submarine warfare, which was of vital importance and of tremendous interest. And the fact that we were pioneering a good deal of it, of course, was generated a tremendous amount of excitement and interest in the Navy.
Both at headquarters and out at the command.
Yeah. But we didn't have any direct involvement because the Buckingham Trials, the Ontario Trials, were concerned more with the flying capability and the operation of an aircraft as such. And at that stage, I don't recall that it was much to do with the anti-submarine employment or the anti-submarine tactics of helicopters, in which case we would have been involved. As I said, as far as I can tell, it was an early stage and they were more concerned with the flying capabilities of it.
So when you became ACNS Air and Warfare, can I assume that you had more of a role as it related to the helicopters than you did when you were ACNS Warfare?
But by then I think it was pretty well firmly established that this was a viable operation and the idea was just to get on with it. I don't recall anything particularly dramatic or exciting or any major major crossroads or crisis or big decision. I think it was a go situation. We were just getting on with the development of the thing.
And part of getting on with these early trials, the RCN was also in the midst of a fight with the RCAF for control of maritime aviation. You were in headquarters in 57. I was wondering if you had any comments about the ongoing inter-service rivalry between RCAF and RCN as it related to the helicopters and maritime aviation generally.
You know, I don't recall that, and I can't think why not. There was always a certain amount of niggling going on in the Sea Air Warfare Committee, sniping at each other, although personally we were all on pretty good terms. But as a matter of philosophy, about which I felt very strongly indeed, I felt very strongly personally that flying over the ocean was the job of people who had an affinity with the sea. The airplane was a tool to be used by anybody who had need of it. And so there were suggestions from the staff that we should do a paper and expose this whole business, I'll leave that, of the control of maritime aviation and bring it out on the floor. And I went along with this. I set up a little team of two people, two or three, I forget now, to develop an appreciation of this whole thing. And left them to it, and in due course they produced a paper, which we put forward. I don't think personally that I had any expectation that anything would come of it, partly because it was really too late. It should have been done during that wartime period when we were beginning naval aviation, but obviously the circumstances were such that it couldn't be tackled then. But since then, there was no possible way when the Air Force would agree to losing what was a very important component of their operation, or that the government would approve it. But anyway, it was worth having the thing on record. So nothing came of it. Because of the fact that it wasn't really a practical possibility, then Chief Naval Staff Admiral de Wolfe had a firm conviction that it was better to maintain good relations with the Air Force rather than having a cut-down, drag-out fight for which there would be no satisfactory end. And so he vetoed the whole thing. And at the time, I think in myself, I agreed with this. But nevertheless, because of my own strong feelings about it and the strong feelings within the aviation branch, I was quite happy to have the thing brought up.
Admiral DeWolf was a very keen supporter of naval aviation. Yeah. Would that be an accurate assessment?
Yes. Yes, oh yes. He was certainly a supporter of naval aviation and the use of aircraft at sea. And that aviation should be a component part of the fleet. But very few people got close to Admiral DeWolf. He was a peppery little bugger. And I remember on one occasion we had, when I was in plans, I was director of plans, there had been some NATO thing that had to be produced in a hell of a hurry. And my staff stayed up all night producing this paper, and I was completely, I was rather pleased with it. But anyway, I took it into 9:30 in the morning, took it into Harry DeWolf, who was vice chief then. And he looked at it, and then he threw it at me. And it hit me on the chest and fell on the floor. It was quite a bulky piece of the stuff. And so there's a lot of balls. Go back and do it again. So I went out and I told the secretary, and I said, I thought it was pretty poor. And he said, well, you silly bugger. Everybody knows you shouldn't see Harry DeWolf before 10 o'clock in the morning. You shouldn't have gone in there. So I got no sympathy for him. But to go back, the old guard of the Navy, who had had very little exposure to aviation at sea during the war or thereafter, were never quite sure about naval aviation. A, naval aviators were a different kind. I could relate to them because of my own background as a reservist and before the war, which had been in some respects perhaps a little harum scarum, that naval aviators were apt to be. They were also different because they were much closer in peacetime, certainly, to extreme danger and fish heads were, which set them apart. They were still sailors and still deeply conscious of the fact that they were naval officers. Naval flying was different, and this gave them a cachet and an ethos that they treasured and that was different. So in a way they were slightly set apart. And also many of the older naval officers had not accustomed themselves psychologically to the fact that naval aviation was an integral part of the maritime battle. Certainly the anti-submarine battle, which was our area. And it is not unfair, I think, to say that naval aviation was never wholeheartedly and completely, emotionally, mentally accepted. I don't know to what degree that touched Harry Wolfe. As I said before, he was a person you couldn't get to know. And don't forget that I, as an ex-reservist, was never quite within the psychological inner circle of the Canadian Navy. I only once, at least, yes, I never once had any criticism of my performance in the sense of, oh, he's a bloody reservist, what do you expect, that kind of thing. Never once. Operationally and on the surface, I was totally accepted, but I never quite became an insider. So I was never privy to what Harry de Wolfe's inner thoughts were on this subject.
I'll just stop it there and turn the tape over.